Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
A dead boy is a horrible thing. March 23rd, 1924, Chicago, Illinois. Nathan Leopold woke at 7:15 a.m. He called a friend and asked if they would cover for him in class that day. He then got ready for the day. When Nathan was eating breakfast, Richard Loeb arrived as planned. The pair carried a bucket, soap, brush, and clothes out to the garage. The cleanup is proving to be more challenging than expected. The blood set in and is matted in clumps. There is skin, bone fragments, brain matter, and vomit. Human waste that neither Leopold nor Loeb accounted for in their plans. The two have to recycle the water often. Within 30 minutes, their arms burn. It's exhausting work. Nathan is focused on the endless scrubbing when he turns to see the family chauffeur standing in the garage, a puzzled look on the witness's face. He asks if they need help cleaning the car. Nathan explains the two spilled an entire bottle of wine and feel that it is their responsibility to clean the mess. The chauffeur asks if he could be of any assistance at all. Nathan requests stronger soap and another bucket. When the chauffeur returns, he explains the only soap he has is likely too strong and could damage the paint job. Richard takes the soap and begins using it, despite these warnings. The chauffeur sighs. There would be discoloration. He knows it. Nathan approaches the chauffeur. He's drenched in sweat. He asks the chauffeur to keep what he saw today to himself. He explains that he and Richard are embarrassed, and they don't want anyone to know. At the same time, a handcar works its way down a railroad. Four members of a railroad crew ride in the car. They make steady progress towards Wolf Lake. Paul Korf is head of crew. It's a clear day. Not a cloud in the sky. Paul isn't aware. He couldn't be. But his day is about to get more interesting. Richard is enraged that Nathan's chauffeur witnessed the pair washing the evidence from the car. He paces and is grumbling about having the worst luck. He tells Nathan that if their plan wasn't so well thought out, they'd be caught already. That he and Leopold can't afford any further mistakes. They need to be careful. In private, Nathan has become less confident in Richard's abilities as a criminal mastermind. There have been mistakes, and what annoys him the most is Richard's constant worrying. Nathan is supposed to be the neurotic one. He needs Richard to remain strong. At the end of this toxic train of thought came love. In the black folds of Nathan's doubt, his loyalty reawakens, so he does his best to comfort his beloved and master. He reminds Richard that the chauffeur has been in Nathan's family since before he was born. If the chauffeur found a body in the car, he'd likely offer to aid in the disposal, and that Richard knows this. He tells his shaken friend and lover to just relax. This calms Richard and gives him a needed burst of confidence, energy. He reminds himself that he needs to keep his nerves in check. They have a ransom to work out, after all. The handcar is in between Wolf and Hyde Lake now. Paul Korf looks up and sees a man waving him down. That waving man is Tony Menke, and he's found something. Paul stops the cart. As he approaches Menke, he can hear him shouting in Polish. Paul and his men follow the man. He's worried about where this is going. Not speaking a lick of Polish isn't helping the situation. Menke, Paul, and his men arrive at the culvert. Surrounding the pipe is darkened wood, splintered and wet, cement jutting from tightly packed dirt. From the otherwise dark hole, in the center of the pipe, dangles two pale limbs. These are the legs of Bobby Franks. Paul Korf pulls the body of the 14-year-old from the pipe while his men grab a canvas sheet from their handcart. The sheet is spread on the ground. Paul gently lowers the boy to the canvas. He stares at the boy for a moment, feeling a knot in his chest. Paul doesn't believe the boy drowned. If he did, where are his clothes? Paul lets the dirt he's clenching sift from his fingers and begins the search of the area, first with his eyes, then with his feet. His men watch on in unbroken silence. A dead boy is a horrible thing, a black thing, not easy to comprehend. Paul spots something, a pair of spectacles, eyeglasses. Why would the boy have been out here with only eyeglasses? Had his friends taken his clothes in jest? Paul had questions, but not a lot of answers. The glasses don't look like a boy's pair. They're black, round, and stylish in a way that adults wear. Maybe something like an accountant. The police arrive and stand around Bobby's broken body. They ask the railroad men if any items have been found. Paul hands over the eyeglasses. Jacob Franks is phoned, but the description doesn't match because the body is described as that of an 11-year-old. The evening before, Richard and Nathan played cards late into the night. Now, the day of the ransom, nothing is going to plan. Nothing. Leopold and Loeb can feel everything coming apart. They'd cleaned the rental car as best as they could, but Nathan didn't feel happy with how clean it turned out. Every time they scrubbed the car, buckets of red water were emptied. Even if you can't see the blood with your naked eye, it seemed to now exist as part of the fabric of the vehicle, and any splash of water was likely to reveal it. But they have to return it. Keeping the rental car can only lead to suspicion. A note for Jacob Franks won't stick to its intended location. The metal resistive to the adhesive. The two each take turns trying to attach the note, pressing as hard as they can. But they watch the tape peel away each time. They try lodging a corner of the note in points of the surface that give away. To their horror, the note blows away when left unrestrained. After retrieving the note, they crumple it up. Better to forgo a stage of the ransom than have it become a dead end. A second call is placed. This time, the family member that answers acts like a nervous wreck. Leopold has to repeat the address multiple times, and he's still not sure it registered. He'd say a number, and the person on the other end would say, "What's that?" And he'd have to say it again. Journalists interview Samuel Edelson. It starts with the Chicago Daily News, but the Evening American soon follows. Edelson confides what he knows, but only under a vow of silence. This leads to a chain of events that tie Bobby missing to the boy found in the culvert. Part 2, The Game at Play. On a hunch, an editor at the Daily News investigates the body found near the railroads. He discovers that the child's body found in the culvert pipe is being held at a nearby funeral home. A reporter named Alvin Goldstein is dispatched to the funeral home. When Goldstein arrives, he is met with a reporter from the Evening American. It seems that they both had the same hunch. After inquiring about the body, Alvin feels he may have a match. He calls his supervisor at the Daily Mail and relays the information. When the conversation finishes, the supervisor then phones another reporter he had dispatched to the Franks' residence. At the train station, Richard purchases a ticket to Michigan City. He's dressed in a disguise, all black, complete with dark glasses and a hat, looking like something out of one of his mystery novels. This is still all a big game to Richard Loeb. You'd think by now things would have fully become real, but no, he's currently decked out like a comic book character, living out his fantasy of being a criminal mastermind. Upon boarding the train, Richard finds the empty telegraph box. In it, he places an envelope in such a way that it's visible to someone looking for it, but not easily found by a curious passerby. Another step complete in an overcomplicated plan. The letter contains more steps for Jacob Franks to carry out. Richard disembarks from the train. He's satisfied no one has recognized him. Even if a man in black is later reported, he doesn't see it coming back to him. Nathan is at a nearby cafe, reading the afternoon paper. He feels a cold jolt strike through his body. Bobby Franks has been found. According to the paper, the authorities don't know it's Bobby, but his body has been found. How did it happen overnight? He and Richard had worked so damn hard. They'd been meticulous. Nathan felt disembodied, his consciousness adrift from his person. It's Richard grasping his shoulder that pulls Nathan back to reality, back in the cafe. And when they locked eyes, Richard understands immediately. An impatient knock on the front door at the Franks' residence. A cab driver stands in the door. He wants to know who needs his service. It's Samuel Edelson who answers the door. Edelson knows Bobby is dead. He believes this cab is the link to Bobby's killers. Edelson asks who called for a cab. The driver tells him Jacob Franks. Edelson's mind is racing too fast to think. He asks the driver to please hold on for a moment, and he goes back into the home to confide in Jacob on the driver. Jacob, Bobby's father, wants to go with the driver. He wants a chance to find who murdered his son. There is an argument between the two men. Samuel Edelson does his best to rein Jacob in. He explains that they have no idea where the cab will go, that Jacob could be walking into an ambush. In fact, could be next up for ransom. Jacob sees reason. Still, Samuel wants to talk with the cab driver. Maybe there is a way to use him for their advantage. Edelson opens the front door and finds that the cab is gone. Richard and Nathan can feel their ransom slipping away. Richard argues against continuing. Their roles have been reversed as Nathan continues to pursue completing their task. This has become important for him. He considers Richard his master and lover. Nathan doesn't want to fail their first big crime. He fears Richard will leave him if this happens and find a new partner. Nathan puts his foot down and insists on calling the drugstore. He stomps away to purchase a slug for the payphone. Richard stands watching his friend leave to make the call. Nathan looks sick, paler than Richard has ever seen him, even compared to the day of the murder. Richard takes a breather and tells himself that they need to adapt. He and Nathan are superior men. They can regroup and restructure their plan. Maybe the best bet is to set Jacob up for the ransom, never collect the money. It could buy some time. The challenge is Nathan's unwillingness to adapt. Richard checks the time. It's 2:47. They have a train to catch at 3. Should he step in and stop Nathan now? He has never seen his friend act so demanding. Usually it's Richard that calls the shots. Richard crosses the street to the drugstore. Nathan is visibly and audibly shaken while on the phone. Mid-sentence, Nathan stops and stares at the phone in his hand. "He hung up on me," Nathan tells Richard. It's now clear to Richard, the ransom is over. The Franks family know. The body must have been identified. The druggist likely has no idea what Nathan was talking about. It's now time to adapt or face consequences. What Richard doesn't know is that the hunt is already on. The Harvard school where Bobby attended is reeling. Classes might as well have not been held, as gossip has taken over every class. Students can't be kept quiet. In between classes, teachers gossip about the murders among themselves. The police investigation is fully underway. Pressure from the public has become overwhelming. The murder of a child who belongs to a wealthy and respected member of the city carries with it further pressures. Jacob Franks has connections. He's not afraid to make things hell for investigators. All it would take is one call to the press if he felt that detectives weren't doing their job. Jacob Franks has put out a $5,000 reward for information leading to the capture of those responsible. Adjusted for inflation, that's just around $90,000. The police station offers $1,000, and multiple news organizations match Jacob Franks' price of $5,000 for information leading to capture. From the start, the story creates a media circus. A blanket of information about the crime envelops the entire city, stirring its citizens into a frenzy. The murder of Bobby Franks becomes an omnipresent part of Chicago life for its residents. There's nowhere you can go and not talk about the Bobby Franks murder. The pervading theory is that something went wrong during the ransom. Investigators know this not to be the case due to extensive damage done in the attack. This was always intended to be a murder first, ransom second. Another theory is that Bobby fought and lost a fight against a sexual predator. Part 3. The Supermen.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You know, listener, finances is a subject that I know some people like to avoid. But coming off of a large move myself, in which I spent in the neighborhood of $7,000 to $10,000 to move cross state, finances have been on my mind ever since. My wife and I, we've hit a point where we've realized it's time to make some serious money moves, to take control of my finances by using a Chime checking account with features like no maintenance fees, fee-free overdraft up to $200, or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. And hey, let me tell you, we've all experienced overdraft before. Chime has overdraft protection, with Chime allowing you to overdraft up to $200 with no fees. Get spotted on debit card purchases and cash withdrawals. No money fees or maintenance fees. Over 50,000 fee-free ATMs. To date, Chime has spotted members over $30 billion. Make your fall finances a little greener by working towards your financial goals with Chime. Open your account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank, N.A. or Stride Bank, N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in Spot Me and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details. While Leopold arrives home from the train station, he doesn't find relief from his worries. The murder is the talk of the household. Leopold had never shied from gossip, known to interject whenever given the opportunity. Family members are curious about his theories on the murder. Nathan can feel their eyes on him. He can't take it. Nathan excuses himself. He rushes from his front door, begins to aimlessly walk down his block. He's lost in thoughts. He and Richard had done a lot to cover their tracks. There was even a small debate on what to do with the rental vehicle. Both had cleaned the car as much as possible, but the water never stopped running red. Nathan experienced a sudden shock. He ran face to face with his former instructor from the Harvard school, Mr. Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell asked Nathan if he's heard about the Franks boy. Nathan says he did not. His instructor explains it's the talk of the school. It's believed that Bobby is the boy found near the railroad tracks. His former instructor explains that it's believed that Bobby Franks was part of a ransom gone wrong. Nathan is finding it difficult to breathe. His legs feel weak. He can feel the palms of his hands growing wet, sweat pouring from his face and neck, wetting his hair, the collar of his shirt. Did you know him, Nathan? What? The Franks boy. Did you know him? No. You feeling okay, Nathan? You look pale. Nathan looks around. The windows of buildings nearby seem to shift, his breathing getting tight. Mr. Mitchell, I'm thirsty. I'm sorry. I'm just really thirsty. And with that, Nathan begins to sprint. He can't feel his feet touch the pavement. A block away, Nathan is bent over, gasping for air, his heart racing. Sweat pools on his chest and the small of his back. His hands tremble. After a moment, Nathan gathers himself. A strange feeling takes over. His fear is replaced with a feeling of accomplishment, a feeling of pride. Even if the town didn't know it was he and Richard that committed the murder, in a way, the two are now famous. Everyone knows their acts. The crime currently discussed from town meetings to hushed whispers. Nathan feels powerful, excited. With a swell in his chest and a light foot, he turns around and heads home. Nathan is ready to face his family. He is a Superman after all. Richard participated in the gossip from the start. He became a popular choice to discuss the crime. His theories were well thought out and well regarded by his peers. Richard theorized to friends and family that maybe there were more steps in the ransom, but they were cut short, probably by unforeseen circumstances. Maybe there were more than one killer, perhaps two. Maybe it wasn't an accident, but in cold blood, a joy kill. Richard talked to friends and family about a whole litany of details not yet released to the public. While Nathan found himself reveling in the power, Richard fed on the attention. He couldn't come out and say he killed Bobby Franks, but he wanted to fly close to the sun. Richard found pleasure in that. It was part of his fantasy. Richard propositions two reporters. They are James Mulroy and Alvin Goldstein. These are the two that were involved in discovering the identity of the body. Richard tells the reporters an idea came to him. If he were planning a ransom, he'd arrange it so that Jacob Franks was called from a drugstore. Richard suggests that he and the reporters visit different drugstores and see if they had any strange visits or calls. The reporters are resistant to the idea. To them, it seems like a crackpot theory from a gossipy young man. But Richard is persistent. He explains that he can always take his idea to other reporters. The two reporters exchange looks. The theory is illogical, but the two fear getting scooped. Richard, the reporters, and Richard's friend, Howard Mayer, go on the trip together. They hit several drugstores. On the way to each drugstore, Richard is open that he never much cared for Bobby. He considered him arrogant, that the money made him stuck up. Richard makes a strange offhand comment. If he were to murder someone, someone like Bobby wouldn't be the worst choice. The drugstore seemed to turn no leads. The rain falls hard from an overcast sky, making it impossible to remain dry between each exodus from the warmth of the car to whatever new fruitless drugstore visit is next. Mulroy and Gavin find that they are sick of this game. Their clothes are soaked through to their socks. They opt to stay in the car for the next several visits. This is when Richard decides to strike. Without the reporters knowing, he has to be taken to the correct drugstore. Richard, with his friend Howard behind him, marches briskly to the druggist. Putting on a show for Howard, he begins interrogating the employee. "Yesterday, did you get a call from someone?" The druggist explained he receives a lot of calls. "Did you get one asking for Jacob Franks?" The druggist's eyes expose his shock. He places his fist to his mouth in contemplation for a moment. The druggist looks up at Richard. He explains that he did and has been thinking about it all day, that he's considered going to the police with this information. The druggist asks what this all means. Richard smiles at the druggist. He doesn't say another word, and with his confused friend trailing him, leaves the drugstore. Richard asks for the reporters to not use his name when calling the police. The police attempt to trace the call, but it's no use. Before they left, Richard purchases a stack of newspapers. On the ride back to their school, Richard is floating with pride. He feels a sense of satisfaction. He has outsmarted a peer and two reporters, scooped them on their own stories. Let them run the story, and they have to live with the knowledge that it was he that did the legwork. Howard asks if he can borrow one of Richard's newspapers. Richard denies this request. He tells his friend that the newspapers are for his mother, and that she'd notice if they were gone through. "Listener, this isn't the truth. These papers are for Richard. He doesn't want creases in his souvenirs." Nathan doesn't share Richard's excitement. He oscillates between basking in the power to fear and even regret. Without Richard, Nathan never would have committed such a crime. We've seen this throughout history. Eric and Dylan, the most obvious examples. Without a dominant personality type, some infamous killers would have fallen into obscurity. Nathan is furious when he learns of Richard's charade with the reporters. He asks Richard how he could be so stupid. Richard isn't affected. He reminds his friend that it was Nathan that left his glasses at the site they dumped the body. Richard thought it was him at first. He was stretching when he heard the sound. In the end, it was Nathan who made the mistake. Richard presses Nathan, asks how he hadn't heard them drop. Not informing his friend, he himself had heard them. Nathan explains that he must have been lost in thought, that someone between the two of them has to be thoughtful. Richard presses on. "You should have heard it, Nathan. Your glasses fell," Richard says with a smile, showing a sadistic side. "That wasn't very thoughtful." Nathan's eyes fill with tears. He's both angry and sad. "Our perfect plan is falling apart, Richard. We'll look like fools. We'll lose our lives, lose each other." Nathan is sobbing now. He and Richard never argue. He has a headache. This is all too much. Richard embraces his friend, his sadistic spell seemingly passed. He tells Nathan it's gonna be okay, while Nathan cries, face pressed to Richard's chest. When the ordeal is finished, Nathan and Richard destroy the typewriter. They use pliers to mangle it, each key ripped from its place. Leopold and Loeb sit in silent reflection as they drive to the bridge. The moon casts a glow over the night. Flashlights won't be needed. At the bridge, found near a lagoon, Nathan gets out and tosses the typewriter keys into the water. They make a plink sound as they hit the water. Back in the car, they're off to another location. Nathan is somber. He sits shrunk in the passenger seat, eyes distant. Richard can't find the words to comfort his friend. They pull into the stone bridge at a nearby harbor. Nathan quickly exits the vehicle. He lugs the damaged typewriter out of the car without a word. Nathan balances the heavy piece of equipment on the edge of the guardrail for a moment. This typewriter was once a symbol of hope for he and Richard, the beginning of their life together as a world-famous crime duo. Nathan releases the typewriter to the dark water below. He watches as the water rises, bursting into the air, the heavy metal plunging into the dark nothing. Nathan climbs back in the car, and Richard begins the drive to the south shore. There, they arrive in a small secluded area where no one can bother them. Nathan grabs the large blood-stained blanket. The blanket hadn't been burned, as Richard had considered it too dangerous to do it at home. The fire is large. Burning the blanket away slowly, the cloth curls into black char. For a moment, while the flames roar, Nathan feels healed by the dancing flames, the pleasant, almost too hot, heat on his face, and Richard by his side. There by the fire, Richard gives Nathan one of his favors. He lowers his friend's pants, and Richard tells him to just relax. On the ride home, Leopold and Loeb are happier than they've been in days, jubilant even. Richard agrees that he would partake in no more fancy stunts. He would fly no closer to the sun, not only for his sake, but for Nathan's too. For Nathan's part, he is in more love with Richard than ever during this ride. This is a special night for our world-famous crime-committing duo. It's the last evening they will spend together before their house of cards falls. Things get bad from here out for Leopold and Loeb. These episodes were, of course, ironically titled The Perfect Crime. Detectives have been hard at work. This is a crime that has shaken the city to its core. A 14-year-old, wealthy, white child draws a lot of attention during that era. And for Richard and Nathan, the cat and mouse game is about to be over before it even started. But for now, I think that wraps things up. I know I said these episodes would be three parts, but there is so much to cover and expand on, and I don't want to skip any of it. Patreon listeners will have part four weeks before main feed subscribers, just like they had this episode over a week early. Even $1 will get you that early access. I thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.
It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. And now I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.